22-3101 and 22-3102, Brooke Clark et al. Versus A&L Home Care and Training Center, LLC, et al. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. McIntyre, you may proceed for the appellants, cross-appellees.
Thank you, sir. May it please the court. Your Honor, Scott McIntyre on behalf of A&L Home Care, Donetta Abbott, Ms. Donetta Abbott, and Ms. Ruthie Lucas. Your Honors, we are asking this court to return the power to the district courts and to unshackle district judges to consider evidence from both employers and employees as they make this all-important decision whether to certify FLSA collective actions. The court should make clear, just as the Fifth Circuit did, Your Honors, in Swales, that the amorphous Lusardi test is a standard without a standard. It's standardless. The court should hold that lower courts should permit discovery that's tailored and rigorously enforce the similarly situated element on motions to certify. The court should move to a rule of law-based approach. We have multiple courts who have found, including the Federal Court of Claims recently, that this standard is too amorphous. We have judges applying various standards, some courts applying evidentiary requirements, some courts looking at the pleadings alone, and that the standard results in different outcomes. It's unpredictable. Yes, Your Honor.
If you return the discretion to the district court, you're going to end up with even a broader range of decisions on that level.
Well, by returning discretion, I mean to say to consider evidence, Your Honor, and part of that returning of discretion is with the standard defined, to have some parameters around the standard, and we submit that the rigorous enforcement that Swales talks about is the standard that should be at issue. That's more akin to what happens in the second test, the so-called second stage of the current Lusardi test, which is well developed here in the Sixth Circuit. We think that standard is more akin to what should be applied. And we have that applied, but unfortunately not too often, because these cases bite the dust, respectfully. They're gone after the certification is made, because it's just too expensive for small clients and even large multinational conglomerates to defend these cases that involve millions of dollars in cost of discovery. And the Supreme Court has honed in on that. It goes back to Twombly and Iqbal. These costs of discovery are not just in class actions, they're also in these collective actions.
Well, it's really not the cost of discovery so much as it is the potential exposure, I would think, in terms of the potentially coercive effect of certification.
Well, I respectfully submit it's both, Your Honor. It's certainly, there's a lot at play.
You're going to have to engage, I mean, under the regime that you want, the Fifth Circuit regime, you have to engage in at least kind of, I don't want to say class-based, like collective-based discovery focused.
Yes, notice
similarity.
Sorry, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Notice discovery. Some courts in the wake of Swales, and that's the point with the discretion, Judge White, is to allow the district judge to tailor it. It won't be, Your Honor, Judge Kethledge, the kind of broad-based discovery that a class action would have. That, in some cases, it might be broader, but that would be the district court's decision, getting input from the lawyers before we go down this path.
So I guess what you're, I mean, the way you're describing this is that the district courts currently feel compelled to grant this conditional certification upon a very light showing of similarity.
That's absolutely true, Your Honor. And I think,
and so you want us to say, hey, you don't need to do that. But you do want us to say, actually, to the contrary, you need to do a rigorous determination. It's something basically like the second step of Lusardi or whatever.
Yes.
And you have to do that before you start treating people as similar.
That's correct. That's absolutely true, Your Honor. And I think the judge, Judge McFarland below, called it meager and vague. And I can't speak for Judge McFarland, but reading his opinion, those are his words. And I think if this were set, it's the discovery issue and it's the standard that's applied. If it was made clear that this meager and vague almost always happens, we hear different characterizations from different judges. Some judges say it should happen in almost all cases. It's modest, it's meager. All of these adjectives, if this court can make clear that no, it's rigorous. It's more akin to the second stage. Similarly situated has a well-defined meaning in the law. And we have scenarios. Well,
really? Judge Willett didn't think so. And
well, it's applied, I should say, Judge. It's applied in many contexts. For example, in the ADA context, in the Title VII context, you know, this court has a well-defined test. Same position, same supervisor.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's impossible.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd go as far as you did, but all right.
It's to me that there are three different scenarios we could go with here. I mean, you could go with a requirement that notice go out with a meager showing, or you could go with the Swales approach, which is that notice cannot go out until you've done a rigorous analysis, or a third approach is it's up to the district court what they want to do.
I think that's fair, Judge Bush.
Now, what if we went with a third approach? Do you think did Judge McFarland indicate that he would, if he felt like he had that discretion, would do more here?
I do. I think we argue for the rigorous approach, even if you characterize it as the third approach. Rigorous, and again, everything in the law is subject to some discretion, even the rigorous analysis. There's some body of law as to what that means, but that would still give judges discretion. You know, with the rigorous approach,
but your complaint is you think our case law has that the district judges are viewing our case law as binding them to take a meager approach.
I do, and we see that in the wake of Swales. We see some other opinions here in the Southern District, for example, who no one wants to jump out on a ledge, so to speak, and do something that the Sixth Circuit doesn't approve and then result in potentially violating the standard. And it's path dependence, as Swales says. It's inertia. You know, this is the standard that's been applied. Practically speaking, you see the descriptions kind of like the summary judgment standard that appears in all these opinions. This same case law, they don't always cite Lissardi, but if you trace it back, it goes to a Sixth Circuit case that cited Lissardi in 1987. So it's path dependent, Your Honor, and I think if we're able to say rigorous, no, this has some teeth to it, but that would certainly...
You just want a real determination, not this sort of, before all these consequences follow.
That's absolutely, it's a consequential decision, and take the blinders off, district judges, let them do what they do best, which is to look at the evidence from both sides, apply it to the law, make a reasoned decision. Have a conference early on in the case. This empowers the judges to, frankly, have the discretion to look at these cases on an individualized basis instead of saying, well, this is an FLSA case. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead, Your Honor.
A couple of things. Is it at all significant that the statute doesn't stop running when the action's filed as opposed to class act?
Respectfully, I do not think it's significant here for many reasons, because the court can consider all these issues up front, and it's an individualized determination. And there are, number one, I understand the other side has argued, they call it humanitarian concerns. The statute, as Your Honor is aware,
it's a short limitations period, 2 years.
It's a 2 years period.
Build on Judge White's question. I mean, let's say somebody files, 2 months before the deadline, which is perfectly within one's rights.
Yes.
What about the concern then?
The district judge should have the discretion to tailor the discovery based on all the factors at play. And I would argue, Judge White, that that's one of the factors that the other side can present to the district judge. There's even equitable estoppel as a possibility. There's many remedies, so to speak, to the concern about the statute of limitations running. One of which would be the Department of Labor. They're involved. There can always be complaints. They can file actions. They can get involved. As Justice Judge Posner had mentioned in Espenscheid, Department of Labor, there's always that involvement in these cases that is very important that they have enforcement power too.
I do think the reality is that the process and determination envisioned by the Fifth Circuit is not likely to happen within the limitations period for potentially similar third parties. And so I don't know what the Department of Labor would have to do about that. I mean, we're talking about a statutory limitations period. So do you think, I mean, would you envision equitable tolling being granted fairly liberally by district courts under this regime?
It would be fact specific, and I think sure. the district judges have that discretion that exists now, Your Honor, and I don't think that this decision would impact that. The law would still be the same on that. It might result in having more instances of equitable tolling. Right. That's certainly a possibility, but the standard for equitable tolling is well developed, and that's something that exists in the toolbox for the judges, and certainly plaintiff's attorneys, I could foresee arguing that. And I could see arguing that we need a quicker period of initial discovery. That's something that I could see as well. Yes, Judge White.
No, I mean, equitable tolling is not freely given. It's an exception. So
It is an exception, and there has to be reasons and arguments and rationales for it. And this would be one that I would foresee judges taking a much closer look at based on this development.
Your argument, I mean, you have the overarching argument that we should get rid of Lissardi. Should it matter what the issue is? Because your next argument is about an arbitration agreement, right?
Yes.
So is Lissardi more problematic in that context?
Well, the arbitration agreement, Judge, is a perfect example of why Lissardi is so problematic, one of the very examples and reasons that applies in this case. If we were to refuse Lissardi, then the judges couldn't look at arbitration agreements. That couldn't be one of the aspects that's at the initial case management conference to say, hey, we have arbitration agreements here. There shouldn't be any notices sent to these plaintiffs, opt-ins, potential opt-ins, who've signed arbitration agreement. Then the other side can say, all right, let's look at the arbitration. Is there any legitimate issue? That's something that Lissardi, the new approach under Swales, allows judges to consider.
A little different.
Yes, sir.
Does it, Matt, is it reasonable to say that in this case, the problem isn't Lissardi, the problem is the way we deal with arbitration agreements? Or in other words, to say an arbitration situation is sort of different from the usual Lissardi context?
I respectfully, no. It's not limited, Judge, to arbitration agreements. And I would cite, if I could give you a quote from the Federal Circuit, in this Vaulty versus United States case from 2021, it identifies two cases from this court and a third case from this court that fairly epitomizes the issues we have. It cites Belcher versus Shoney's, White versus MPW Industries, both Tennessee cases, and then the Harrison versus McDonald's Southern District of Ohio case. Both of those cases the Tennessee cases said the decision is strictly on the pleadings, didn't involve arbitration. So the judges in those cases said, we're going to make this decision based on the pleadings alone. We have a judge who's no longer on the bench in this McDonald's case who actually rejected not only the pleading argument, but said, I'm going to reject hearsay in the affidavit. This affidavit has hearsay, this declaration. I'm not going to consider anything but admissible evidence. So we have all these widely divergent decisions because there's no clear standard. And that, respectfully, arbitration is a product of the standard, but it's not the reason for it. Arbitration is one example of how the extreme, frankly, that under the extreme version of Lissardi, we can't even look at arbitration agreements because that's evidence. There's an argument it goes to the merits. We hear these canards that this is a merit issue, kick the can down the road, we can't look at this. That routinely happens, and it's not a pejorative, it's because there isn't a clear standard. And without a clear standard, I go back to one of my favorite law review articles as a first-year law student, Justice Scalia.
All right, I'm sorry, but we've been a lot of red today.
Oh.
Thank
you. Thank you, Your Honor.
I get into it on rebuttal.
Yes, three.
We're going to hear from Mr. Mansell.
Thank you, and good morning. May it please the court, I'm Greg Mansell on behalf of Appellees and the cross appellants in this matter. And I don't think this is a complicated analysis here on all three of the issues if the purpose of the FLSA is taken into account. I didn't call it, and the plaintiffs didn't call it, a humanitarian law. The Supreme Court called it a humanitarian law. It's a remedial law that's designed to protect workers from exploitation and wage theft. And I agree that there isn't really a well-defined, similarly situated. It's not defined in the FLSA. There is sparse precedent from the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has addressed similarly situated in Hoffman-LaRoche. And what the Supreme Court said is that the district court has discretion under Rule 83, but here are the guidelines and principles under which you should exercise that discretion. But we're not going to tell you how to exercise that discretion. And those three principles are: the benefits of proceeding collectively depend on employees receiving accurate and timely notice so they can make an informed decision on whether to opt into the case. Early judicial intervention by court-authorized notice counters the potential misuse of the class device through misleading communication. And that courts must be careful to respect judicial neutrality and avoid the appearance of judicial endorsement on the merits of the action.
But no, I mean, those factors just, didn't bear on the issue we have here. I mean, in that case, the court wasn't deciding this issue. It was just deciding whether the court can ever be involved in sort of recruiting new people to join an existing lawsuit.
Right. Hoffman said this is what courts are allowed to do when determining similarly situated and whether notice should go out to the class. And outside of this, they exercise their discretion under Rule 83.
Okay. But, you know, discretion is usually bounded by law. And here you have a statute that says a plaintiff can bring an action, you know, of this sort on behalf of himself or herself and similarly situated parties, right?
Correct.
And it's and so there's it seems to be common ground here that there are significant consequences that flow from a determination that there are in fact similarly situated parties. I mean, there are serious consequences to that. Notice is sent with the court's blessing. The notice that you all wanted says this is not a plaintiff solicitation, this is a court-approved message. So notice is sent with the court's imprimatur to a bunch of people who are not present in the lawsuit. And then, obviously, I think as a practical matter, there are consequent pressures on the defendant's side to settle. So we have we've got three amicus briefs here precisely because there are significant consequences that flow from the similarity determination. And I guess my question to you is, why shouldn't that have to be a determination in earnest? Not some milquetoast, you know, there's some scintilla of evidence or something. Why shouldn't a district court have to make a real determination of similarity before the court itself involving its, the court itself, you know, being involved in actions that have these significant consequences in the case? Just do a real determination. Why
sure.
not?
And I think it's pretty simple. And I think this is why these district courts have developed the two-step approach. It's because the consequences to the individual are far more severe than the consequences to the business. And this is a statute to protect individuals, not businesses.
Well, let's set aside the purpose type stuff. I mean, so tell me, you're talking about the consequences to the third parties who aren't there yet. Is that
right.
Fair? And you're getting at the limitations issue.
Yes.
Is that right? And that's a good, important argument that you make in your brief. Why can't that be addressed by tolling, though, equitable tolling?
Well, so we'd have to develop a whole new set of rules regarding tolling, because right now in the Sixth Circuit, tolling is used sparingly. It's the exception, as Judge White has said. And so if this is going to be a liberal standard in an FLSA case to grant tolling, then that set of precedent needs to be laid out. And it's not right now. And there's actually district court judges that say, we cannot exercise tolling on a class-wide basis. It's never appropriate to do it on a class-wide basis. That's one extreme. And then there's others that say, we can't do it until people join the case. And then we have to analyze individually whether that person deserves equitable tolling. This is a rare grant, and this is not something that is provided liberally.
Do you know offhand, I mean, I'm not trying to give you a pop quiz, but do you know offhand what those factors are for equitable tolling? If you don't, it's fine. It's not, it's something, you know, it's in the briefing.
I know that they're laid out in Truitt.
Yeah, okay. I mean, you know, query whether, if we were to agree with the Fifth Circuit, just hypothetically, I mean, query whether we could say that as a general matter, in these sorts of circumstances, with a tight limitations period and the need for discovery as to whether other folks are similarly situated, that that would, you know, often satisfy whatever these requirements are. I mean, if that were a plausible thing to say. I mean, just this scenario, I mean, it's going to have kind of a similar layout where you need discovery, you need a front-end determination, you have a two-year window, and those might all be pretty significant factors in virtually every tolling analysis.
I don't think statute of limitations is the only consequence to the individual, Your Honor. I think if the more time that goes by, and given the individuals that this statute is protecting, it's hourly wage earners, low wage earners, and these individuals move more frequently. They may not have the same address. They usually rent rather than own their apartment or house, and it's going to be harder to get them notice 14 months down the road than it is going to be at the time. And district court judges in our circuit have recognized that, as well as the need to get timely notice to these individuals so they actually receive it.
Let me ask you how these collective actions work. You have one filed, and when notice goes out, the absent people can opt in. But if they don't opt in, do they have the ability to bring their own lawsuit at that point?
Yes.
Okay, so this doesn't preclude multiple collective actions going on. Is that correct? They could bring their own collective action at that point?
They could bring their own individual action. It doesn't affect their right to bring an action for what they're seeking. It would.
I just wondered if you could have competing collective actions going on.
No, and that, I mean, the purpose of the collective action is so that it's brought together in one for judicial economy and efficiency. And so there wouldn't be competing unless there was differing, I guess, groups or classes.
Well, they have their own attorney who wants to bring his own collective action. You could, couldn't you, have two going on at the same time? Anyway, but let me just keep going here. So once the once you've opted in, is it just like a class action then, where the original plaintiffs are representing everyone, or and the absent people who've opted in really don't have a say in what happens in the litigation, or are they actually individually litigating? Is this like a mass litigation where you have a bunch of little suits that are just all together in one suit, or is it more like a class action where you have just named plaintiffs who are representing everyone in the class?
It's more similar to the latter, that there's named plaintiffs, representing
everyone in the class.
Correct.
Because what I'm struggling with is if it's kind of an individual, kind of a mass litigation where you have all these separate suits, it's almost like it seems like that the plaintiff needs to be in the suit before the district court makes determinations on the merits, such as whether or not an arbitration agreement is valid or not, or whether or not there's willfulness. You really need to have the people in the suit first for kind of due process considerations to make a ruling that's binding on those people. But if it's a representative capacity, then maybe there's not that due process problem. That's an amorphous question, but do you understand where I'm going here?
Yes, I don't think that plaintiffs have standing to challenge an arbitration agreement on behalf of putative class members. Putative class members have no rights, so in that way it's different from Rule 23. Rule 23, class members have rights immediately upon filing. A FLSA putative class collective has no rights until they opt in and join the lawsuit. And so an individual, a plaintiff, a representative plaintiff, would have no standing to challenge an individual arbitration, nor would they necessarily have the information.
I guess what concerned me a bit about the district court's ruling here on the arbitration agreements is it was making a ruling on the merits of whether or not those arbitration agreements were valid and precluded people from suing in court. But all the absent people weren't there to be able to litigate that issue. They're just out there, and so there's the determination being made on their behalf without them being in the lawsuit that they have arbitration agreements to prevent them from going to court. How can the court do that without these people actually being present in the suit?
I am not familiar with what would give the authority for somebody to.
That augurs for me why you'd want to have notice earlier, because otherwise you need to have these people in the suit in order to have a ruling on the merits of whether their arbitration agreements are good or not.
Right, and that's right. The first step needs to come before the arbitration decision, where these people join the lawsuit and are able to advance their own defenses to the arbitration agreement.
So when, I'm sorry.
I have another question, but you go ahead and follow up on this.
You had one plaintiff who had an arbitration agreement, right?
Correct.
And she was voluntarily dismissed from the action, right?
We voluntarily dismissed her from the action and sent her individual action to arbitration. Correct.
Okay. So, but yet you want to send notice out to everyone, including those who have arbitration agreements. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, I think the Sixth Circuit case in Taylor versus Pilot Corp highlights the importance of being able to say, yes, this is a valid agreement versus this is not. I did not sign this, or it doesn't cover what I'm alleging here. And in Taylor versus Pilot Corp, they provided the judge a spreadsheet of individuals, the dates they signed arbitration agreements, and the individuals said, I wasn't even employed on that date. And so without having joined the lawsuit, they wouldn't have been able to tell counsel and then the court that they were not actually employed on the date that the employer says that they signed the agreement. Now, with Ms. Clark, she did not dispute the validity of her specific arbitration agreement, but in a class-wide or putative class here, they need to have the opportunity to say this is valid or it is not.
The other ruling that the district court made in limiting the size of the class or the notice was on willfulness, whether or not the defendant acted willfully. And
whether or not what?
Willfulness.
Okay.
So whether or not it's a 3-year statute of limitations versus a 2-year statute of limitations. And the court, I believe, determined there wasn't sufficient evidence of willfulness, therefore 2 years. And that was a merits determination as well, it seems like to me. And I'm wondering how you can make a willfulness determination on the merits for people that aren't in the lawsuit. Again, that just bothers me about it. It seems like that, again, would be something you need to get the people in the lawsuit first before you can make that kind of a ruling.
I agree. In our brief, we provided that there's, when you talk about willfulness, this is a state of mind, and it's usually going to be based on conversations that people may have had individually. Here, the three individuals said, we made complaints to management. Our one management employee said, people made complaints to me. I ran it up the chain. They were aware that people believed that they were being paid incorrectly. The case law says that that is enough to survive summary judgment, that the jury has to make the determination then at that point of what the state of mind of the individual was. Here, the judge said that's not enough to even meet this modest standard.
But presumably it met the Twombly standard. I mean, was there a motion to dismiss filed?
No.
Okay, so there was never a ruling on plausibility of the complaint. Okay. But it wasn't challenged either, so. Okay, that's all I've got.
Judge White, anything else?
No, thank you.
No? Okay, all right, thank you for your argument. We'll hear rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Well, on the arbitration agreement, so the arbitration agreement was presented to counsel. It's the same arbitration agreement. And I submit, Your Honor, for everyone who signed it in this case, Judge McFarland below is following the same approach that the Seventh Circuit outlined in the Bigger versus Facebook case. He's giving an opportunity to raise any issues from counsel who represent the other three individuals and who can communicate. That's something that I think Judge Bush, practically speaking, the way these work in terms to your question practically is that plaintiff's counsel and the employees who are in the case can communicate with other employees. And in the cases I litigate, the ones that are, you know, hot, so to speak, the ones that have great evidence, we see notices filed on a daily basis, sometimes before the notices go out. That was an important part of this, is that no employee opted in. The only plaintiffs were the ones that originally filed. So in many of these cases, you'll have hundreds of opt-ins before the notice even goes out. And that also addresses, Judge White, your concern about tolling and the statute of limitations. There's communication. There's no prohibition, practically speaking. The folks that are in the case can speak with their former coworkers and say, hey, I joined this case. Counsel oftentimes speak and communicate. That happens. So the notice is only part of it. But I would submit that if we look at Chief Judge Sutton in the Canaday case, who talked about employers. To your point, Judge Kethledge, the defendant's rights hang in the balance in these FLSA cases. So the focus, there's always statute of limitations issues. That happens every time there's a plaintiff. But the court should not make this monumental decision to say we can't consider any evidence from the employer. We have to automatically sign this, get this out quickly. All of this desire to consider it without the proper evidentiary basis harms employers. And we have two ladies here, nurses, who founded this business in Appalachia to care for COVID patients, dealing with all of this and the class action. Employers are humans too. And the statute protects, if you go back to the 1947 Portal to Portal Act, the whole opt-in was designed to minimize the litigation that happened. There was an explosion of litigation, much like we've seen in the 2000s in these cases. So it's frankly unfair to argue that this statute is only, it's something to benefit employers. We have to give it this construction.
Who pays for the notice?
Who pays for the notice, Your Honor? That would be discretionary with the judges. Oftentimes these days it's email notice, it's mail notices. The plaintiff's counsel practically oftentimes pays for it, but with email notices, you know, there's no charge essentially.
I guess I probably just don't understand the reality of it, but
yes,
it seems to me that if you send the notice, the crucial decision is step two. You know, who is going to remain in the case? And what is, at that point, you know what you're dealing with. You're saying that employers just settle before they get to step two?
Yes, Your Honor. And the law, you know, the cases we cited, you know, the judicial statistics showing that these cases never, almost never get to the decertification stage. We cited statistics from the administrative office, the numbers of these cases, how rarely they get to the second stage. And there's enormous pressure. Sometimes there's confusion.
But they may settle after discovery.
Sometimes they settle before discovery. It's possible, but the cost of discovery are monumental, especially for a home healthcare company like this that's founded. It's not a conglomerate. It doesn't have in-house counsel.
The cost to an individual of going through all of that can be monumental to that individual, and that's why you're allowed to have these collective actions. So ultimately, even step two fleshes out the issues. I mean, if you, that process in between, that intermediate procedures that are going on, they clarify who really is similarly situated. And you, all you want to do is push that back to before the certification.
We do. We want the similarly situated test to be made, Your Honor, before all of this process starts, before all the wheels turn, and before all of the bad publicity, the motions, all of that practice happens.
But the discovery that's going to be going on, by definition, has to involve all these other people. Because you're not doing discovery on the merits, if I understand it.
Well, again, the merits is confusing. It's the merits, Your Honor, of whether they're similarly situated.
Right.
The ultimate merits, it can be the merits, if there's ultimately a trial, which almost never happens, but it's the merits of whether they're similarly situated. And judges, the standard doesn't make that point, but that's what we're asking
right.
for.
So during that period, you're litigating whether these people are similarly situated. And the only difference is whether the people that you're talking about get notice, or whether they get notice only after you've decided that half of their colleagues aren't similarly situated.
I respectfully disagree with that because there's so many myriad of issues here. The policy, for example, the discovery can involve, there's no discovery now, typically, and so the discovery could be targeted under our approach. It would be limited to the similarly situated issues. But at this point, once the notice goes out, the discovery involves, well, everything. Once discovery, it's not limited. So the discovery we're asking
Wait,
for would be targeted.
A judge under Lusardi cannot say, okay, you can send out your notice, but before step two, I want your discovery to focus on who's similarly situated.
That practically does not happen, Your Honor. Because
is there something that stops a judge from doing that?
Well, it's because it's wide open. You know, the view is that we are getting to the stage of the second stage, and you know, the thought is that's more akin to a summary judgment type standard, the second stage. So the notices go out, the discovery starts, and then the employers have hundreds, thousands, it's a bet the company scenario where once these folks are in the case, they sometimes can have different counsel, you're facing a class action. So it's an immediate class action. Once that decision is made, it's not as if, oh, it's just notices. No, it's a class action for all practical purposes, Your Honor.
But what you want, okay, let's say they sent the notice out to everybody. And certain people opted in, certain people didn't. And some of those people had arbitration agreements. And the judge says, these arbitration agreements are valid. So then you get rid of a ton of people rather than getting rid of one person.
A small employer, Your Honor, don't want to interrupt, but a small employer like A&L or even a large employer, there's costs to having to file those motions. It stirs up litigation, and that's exactly what the Supreme Court and Swales and these other cases are talking about. To send the notices to someone who's not similarly situated to begin with crosses the line to a solicitation tool. So the decision about whether it should go out first should be made before. If the arbitration agreement is valid or not, that should be made before the notices go out. And there's also a problem with the court getting entangled in arbitrations, the FAA, the Federal Arbitration Act. This case is a perfect example. There's been no dispute about the arbitration agreements. The judge has directed that all the arbitration agreements be disclosed. If there is a dispute, that will be ferried out before arbitration.
That's why I asked you the first time around whether arbitration may be different. Maybe there are certain things that make more sense to decide beforehand.
Well, arbitration has separate FAA issues involved in it, you know, because there's the Federal Arbitration Act that prevents district courts from getting entangled in arbitration. But the reason I answered the way I attempted to, Judge, is that we don't want to minimize this in any way. The same concerns are at issue, whether it's arbitration or whether it's something that's, frankly, even more expensive to deal with than arbitration.
What about the example that your friend gave about coming in with a bunch of, the defendant comes in with a bunch of arbitration agreements, you know, says, we have arbitration agreements, don't send notice to people who have arbitration agreements, and then you find out that the person never signed it. How do you deal with that case?
Yes, I've had several cases before this case and after where there are discovery potentially. If there's a legitimate dispute, and this is exactly what Bigger outlines, and this is what Judge McFarland has outlined in his order, if there is a legitimate dispute about these, and the plaintiffs usually represent the same folks, they're at the same company, the plaintiff's lawyers, they get the arbitration agreement, they communicate with the prospective class. If there's a legitimate issue about whether this arbitration agreement is valid, they're oftentimes the same. In this agreement, they're the same agreement. Then that can be decided by the court. It can be raised in that preliminary period before the notice goes out. And there can even be discovery on that in rare cases if there's an issue of...
understand.
Yes.
You have individuals who say that they didn't sign the agreement, even though the company says they signed it.
That's a rare case, Your Honor, yes.
Okay, well, how do they even get involved if they don't get notice because the company asserts that they signed an agreement?
The plaintiff's counsel, for example, or the co-workers would inform the individuals. The arbitration agreements are disclosed, and then they know who the folks are because they have their names on them. And at that point, that's a disclosure of who they are. So,
what's the difference between that plaintiff counsel informing practice and the notice that currently happens after the first stage of Lusardi?
The court isn't involved in it, Your Honor, and it doesn't have the impact and the power of a court imprimatur of saying, this is notice, this is a class action, the settlement, you know, pressure that, you know, the courts speak of. That is not present. The employer, the defense, can't control what the plaintiff's counsel does. And these, as I said, practically speaking, we get notices, we get opt-ins that are filed before the notice goes out. I'm sorry, Your Honor?
They may not even work there anymore. As counsel said, these are generally, you know, lower wage earners, hourly workers who move around. So how are they going to get word of mouth from their coworkers and the people, you know, at the place now, the place of employment at this point?
Well, at the end of the day, the arbitration agreement can stand on its own. It's oftentimes, like in this case, it's the same arbitration agreement. And these are the very small. I've never seen a situation where an arbitration agreement, it's theoretical, where some employer says you...
What about the role of sanctions for attorneys who... Let's say you start one of these actions, a collective action, and I mean... You know that there are these arbitration agreements, that everybody has an arbitration agreement. Why can't sanctions be used to say in that case, well, you know, this was an improper action?
Well, respectfully, the situation we have here, the counsel on the other side knows it's the same agreement, and I'm not suggesting we need that here, but you know, it has to be in good faith, and you know, there are whether there's a legitimate dispute or not is something that could be handled at the conference. There could be sanctions, you know, at the conference to say whether there's a legitimate dispute on discovery. Do you have a real legitimate dispute or not? And to counsel, he hasn't raised any dispute. There has been zero instance in this case because counsel understands that the agreements are valid, I submit.
One last question.
Yes.
This small, you know, two-person nursing business that you're talking about.
Yes, sir.
How many employees are there?
Currently, I am not sure.
I don't mean currently. How many
at the time
get notice?
Well, it's, I don't know the exact number, but it would be 100, 200 employee, between 200 and 100, depending on the time period. It's, these are home health aides, Your Honor, who go out, and a lot of these work in the same building. Some of the plaintiffs works for his own mother in his own home. This is not a huge conglomerate. So we're talking spread out through West Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, maybe 100 employees. That's the entire company. You know, and it varies between the two-year period, you know, sometimes fewer than that. So at various times, there's 100, 200 is my best guess of the whole company. But it would be a huge undertaking for a company like this who has no, who focuses on healthcare, who doesn't focus on litigation. So it's monumental, even though it's not thousands of employees, it still involves a significant burden and cost and expense.
Okay. All right, and she got an answer to her number. All right.
My best guess.
Thank you both for your arguments. Case will be carefully considered.
And thank you, judges.
Thank you.
Clerk may call the next case.
Yes, Your Honor.